They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1 be mine?
Alright, I see by the old clock on John's wrist that it is 11:30. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Brit Track.
Fuck yeah!
Hell yeah! We are doing macrame for Sherlock Holmes. We're going to show you how to create 221 Baker Street using just a few bits of string.
And a kennel.
And a kennel. A dog kennel. The hound kennel of the Baskervilles. No. No, seriously, folks, welcome to the Brit Track. My name is Robin the Hat. I am the assistant director of British Media, and I have been doing the Brit Track for 10 years. Do the panelists want to introduce themselves, or would you like me to introduce you as well? Fine, I'll introduce you then. On my far right is the lovely Taylor Bloomberg, who's been on the track for how many years?
One.
1 year!
Does it count that I've just been here for 3 years?
You've been here at that table for 3 years.
I'm waiting over there.
Wow. And she just moved tonight.
I was a mascot. We were the mascots.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, and to my slightly nearer right is Mr. John Raven.
Hello.
Track for 3 years.
Yes, track resident jackass.
And is Martin Freeman's stunt double for series 3 that hasn't actually been filmed yet. He traveled back in time to be here. Let's give him a hand, folks.
Yeah!
And over here, to my far left, is Mr. Counts Broders, who drives the wonderful taxi in the parade this past Saturday. Let's give him a hand. General Sherlock Holmes know-it-all. And then here on my slightly nearer left is the ghost of Jeremy Pratt. What? Too soon?
Yes.
Oh, well,
good number of years.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are here to talk about the latest iteration of Sherlock Holmes, Sherlock, which takes place, of course, in modern times with Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman in the kitchen roles. Thank you for correcting me. In the roles of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. John Watson. What do y'all would like to start off? Taylor, John? I tell you what, Counts, why don't you give us just a brief background on Sherlock Holmes?
So for the new series?
Just a little bit on the original, you might say.
Well, some of the notes I was looking at, you know, that...
those who don't know.
What's Sherlock Holmes?
So, Holmes first appeared in print in 1887, so this is quite a modern update to go from. And he was featured in 4 novels and 56 short stories. And the first story was A Study in Scarlet. And so that was the piece that Moffat took for doing Study in Pink for the first show. And all but 4 of the stories have been narrated by Dr. Watson. And there were 2 stories that were narrated by Holmes himself. That was The Blanched Soldier and The Lion's Mane. And there were 2 in the third person that Arthur Conan Doyle did. That was The Mazen Stone and His Last Battle.
How many of you knew that Arthur Conan Doyle actually hated the character of Sherlock Holmes? Wow, almost all of you. That's why he killed him off. Do you know why he brought him back? That's right, that's why Sherlock Holmes keeps coming back every decade.
It's one of the interesting things to think about, because if you look at it, he's really the first literary character that comes back from the dead. So, you know, anybody who gets brought back now in comic books...
Yes, we have a comment right off the bat.
Actually, you should blame the Queen of England, because she actually wrote
Conan Doyle and said, "I am outraged. You can't kill Sherlock Holmes. Bring him back from the dead right now." And she wrote her story.
Well, you got to do what Victoria says.
And Arthur Conan Doyle being such a loyal member of society.
Right.
There you go.
All right. Well, let's see. Let's talk about the newest iteration, Sherlock Holmes. Taylor. Tell us a little bit about the history of this show.
Well, this show actually, well, obviously the creators of it are Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss, who I'm sure a lot of us in the room here anyway know from their Doctor Who work, both current work and even farther back, and for Mark even, acting. But they have been kicking around the idea for quite a few years to bring a modern update, and they were actually on a train to Wales when they were discussing this, to work on Doctor Who, and they actually finally managed to push it into gear. And actually, Sue Fletcher, who is Stephen Moffat's wife, is producer on it. So she, and I've heard quite a few things from Moffat, always says that she pushed him into it. Like, they kept talking about it. She's like, "Well, do it." So here it is. So thanks to her.
And just to let you know, if y'all have a comment or a question, please feel free to raise your hand at any time. Because we're up here talking about this, but we want to hear from you. We want to have some interaction going on. If you have any questions, please confess them.
Yes.
Why does Moriarty look so young? If he really set up the whole chemistry thing to Swimmer, but way back in the day when Sherlock was like 12, 16, and first discovered, investigated.
I mean, Moriarty was that much of a psychopath even back then.
Yes, ma'am.
Not a sociopath.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Not a sociopath. B. It's B. Remember.
Hold on, everyone.
This is Moffat and Gatiss. Is that really the Moriarty? Or is that just a stand-in? That's the question I have. Because the very last episode, that's a little sort of, I don't know, in your face, haha, maybe I beat you. So that may not actually be the real Moriarty.
Yes, sir.
Well, one, I think it probably is the real Moriarty, but that's just personal opinion. Maybe you're right, it is Mom.
But well, it is a big departure, though, from traditional depictions of Moriarty. And that's a really big leap. I mean, who else thought that Mycroft was Moriarty in the first episode? I'm wondering why make that big of a leap from the character? Because that's a big gamble. I mean, most people do have a conception of who Moriarty
is. You have to consider, though, that it's traditional depictions and all, but when it comes to the actual, like, the Holmes canon, which is very strongly what Moffat and Gatiss are working off of, he's only in one story.
Fair point.
Mm-hmm. There's not really a whole lot of a basis into it. And the way that he's being woven into the stories that are happening on the show, he's appearing in situations where he normally wouldn't have. So we don't know time frame-wise either how this... I mean, we're going to probably discover that it's pretty close to when he would have appeared in this canon coming up in the next season. But we don't necessarily know how much of a time difference there is either.
And Vision, I see your hands raised, and I'm going to try to go in the order that you raised. I'm starting with this young lady right here, then we're going to go up here, and then the young lady back here, and then I saw someone in the back raising their hand. Go right ahead.
Well, I mean, personally for me, one, I too also thought it was Moriarty. I didn't think it was a stand-in. But I'm also kind of glad that they're kind of depicting him as more closer to Sherlock's age, because I always felt the whole, like, old professor, you know, type deal was kind of overused, and I like how they're going back to saying, you know what, we're just going to stay true to Moriarty's character, you know, the type of person he is, but let's make him a little bit younger, let's make him a little bit more threatening, let's change it up a little bit just to see where it goes. I mean, I thought it was a brilliant choice.
Yes, ma'am.
If you want to talk about departures from depiction of character, let's talk about Lestrade. Okay, so in the books, he is a rat-faced man. How many people think that our lovely, lovely, lovely rat face? Anybody? Anybody? Yeah.
You know, my perception of Lestrade, at least in the books, is that he's happy and willing to consult with Sherlock. Whereas, of course, in the series, it's like, I'm turning to you because I have no other choice, and my entire team hates you.
We have a young lady in the back. Yes.
I think the other thing to consider is that it's very obvious that Moffat kept the basic characters, but changed the timeline substantially to match up with what would be considered the appropriate timeline for these characters in this environment. Sherlock himself is 10 to 20 years younger than he first appears in the series. When you consider that they're talking about, when you're reading the stories themselves, John's actually talking, not when he's actually met Sherlock, but when he actually starts writing. Because he's writing the stories after Sherlock is no longer with us. That's when the first one is actually published.
No.
Yeah.
Well, this is the point.
Anyways, the point is that Sherlock and Moriarty are always supposed to be about the same age, but if you age down Sherlock, you're going to age down Moriarty. The other thing... Yes. The other thing is, actually for me, the more striking difference is not about Moriarty, it's actually about Watson. Because Watson's not an idiot, as the way he's obviously portrayed in a lot of the canon video. Basil Rathbone made, although he's the greatest Sherlock, I think, he made Watson an old fat guy who was only there to support Sherlock's intelligence. And Watson in this new series is to show what he really was in the books, a foil for the reader to interpret what Sherlock is saying.
And it's one of the great quotes that I like about what Holmes says to Watson is like, you're not yourself luminous yet. You help me create, or you help me come to the right idea, basically.
All right, we had this lady, this blonde-haired lady in the shirt right there, then we have this gentleman over here, and then we had a young lady right here, yes. So, did you have a question, man? Did you have your hand up a little bit ago? I am hallucinating, then. We're going to go straight to this gentleman.
One of Lestat's strengths in the canon, I think, is actually that he comes over time to really appreciate Sherlock Holmes. And that's what you're seeing, I think, in depicting the series, is Lestat at the start is essentially similar to Lestat at the start of canon. Although in Victorian terms and mores, Lestat's not going to be as irritable about how Sherlock is interacting with him as he would today. But there's a scene in the canon where Lestat eventually just kind of goes, "You know what, Sherlock? You're awesome." And I think some of what's going on here is that we're seeing the evolution of Sherlock in a much more broad and modern storytelling manner than Conan Doyle did all those years ago. So that's why I was saying in terms of Lestat. And really also in terms of Moriarty, that they're doing modern, that the modern take is more along the lines of generating a storyline than what they did in the past. But basically, here's a guy, all right, we're going to have a fight.
I would be really intrigued in this particular incarnation of canon to know more about the relationship between Lestat and Sherlock pre-John Watson, because you obviously, for instance, in the original novels, you had Holmes was doing cocaine and things, and there's that reference to him having a drug problem, set up the fake drug bust, which leads you to believe that Lestat knew that about him already, that he had been, doing drugs and things, which today, is illegal. And I think that also changes the dynamic significantly compared to
Yeah, I mean, in that time change again, and something we were discussing in the last panel with the British crime shows is that, now today police work is so incredibly bureaucratic that back in the Victorian era, it might have been much easier for them to bring in a consultant rather than in the modern era where bringing in the consultant is seen as, well, we can't handle this ourselves, or this isn't how things are done, this is against procedure.
Yes, ma'am.
I was going to basically say the same kind of idea you were going for, is that I think in his, the way he is currently in the series, Lestat kind of plays a foil for Sherlock, or at least kind of highlights his more irritating qualities. I think as the series progresses over time, we'll probably see Lestat's opinion changes. Holmes himself grows, and it becomes, if not more sociable, then at least better understands how to interact with people in spite of himself.
Well,
Lestrade has that brilliant line about how one day Holmes was a great man, and one day he could be a good man.
Personally, I don't think Holmes should change at all. Just keep him as kind of this super intelligent kind of asshole. It's just what makes the character more endearing. You know, if you make him more human, you kind of take that away. You know, his treatment of Molly is just it makes you laugh.
Yes, ma'am.
I think that the reason why they keep Sherlock the way he is because John is that element that humanizes him. He's the normal everyman, the complement to Sherlock's sociopathy, whereas John is this approachable guy, and you see it in the second and third episodes as he interacts more. John's apologizing for Sherlock's behavior. John's explaining things to people when they first get really insulted by Sherlock. So I think John is going to be that humanizing that aspect, where as Sherlock will probably stay roughly the same with some character development. Yeah.
Yes.
I think...
Shut up.
Well, I guess it comes back to what I was saying before, is the purpose for the reader, the purpose of John Watson is to not... Let's be honest. John Watson is not the everyman. He is a step above the everyman, but he's below Sherlock Holmes. He is a military officer. He is a surgeon. He has military experience. He has medical experience. These are not everyman qualities. But he's enough of a... he's an intelligent individual who can understand Sherlock and then take that intelligent understanding of what Sherlock is saying and translate it to the everyman. I think making John Watson an everyman lessens him and makes him substandard to Sherlock instead of being the caretaker and controlling influence that he is.
You know, I kind of agree with you. And in fact, I heard someone say compared to Sherlock, Watson is an everyman. But he's not, because Sherlock obviously sees something in Watson that he doesn't see in anyone else on the planet. And that's why Sherlock opens up to Watson as much as he does, because he sees in Watson a kindred spirit, as far as I can see. Or someone who understands him, or who can accept him. The lady in the back, and then this lady over here, and then I see a couple of hands over here. We'll go back to front. Yes?
I think that if you take some previous incarnations of canon have kind of dumbed Watson down to the peril, and it not only devalues Watson, it also makes Holmes less great, because if you have a great character like John and compare him compared to Sherlock, he's not quite sharp, but still great. But if you have him be a bumbling idiot, then how is, you know, being sharper than that any great, like, accomplishment? And I think one of the things that the show has done really well is to show that, like, John Watson is a badass. And that he thinks Holmes is great just reflects even better on Sherlock.
It's like John is sort of his conscience, because you notice that he's been going through the first episode, you have him being very rude and cross and not apologizing for anything, but then the moment he says not good is the moment he's realizing that, you know, John is not happy with what he just said and cares about it. So he hasn't cared about it before then, but then when he asks, you know, and then a bit not good, he's like, oh, well then, change topic.
I really like that comment, but I want to add also to the everyman statement. There's an element to that kind of, well, not stupidity, but that kind of obtuseness that we see sometimes, is that Watson is writing stories, and he's trying to hold back things that he doesn't want the reader to figure out before the big reveal. And, you know, it's something particularly in canon that Holmes is constantly complains about Watson's writing style and how he over-romanticizes things. And so there very seriously could be some elements in the portrayal of Watson in the original series, of him literally writing himself as the person you're supposed to relate to into the stories, if you look at it that way, as someone who doesn't see it right away so that he can reveal it to you later.
The young lady in the back, and then we'll go with this lady over here.
This lady?
Yes.
Well, I think Sherlock needs to be detached. Because in the episode where they had the people who had bombs strapped to them, Watson's getting upset. Watson's saying, oh my God, there's an old lady. She has a bomb strapped to her. Do something, do something. And Sherlock says, I am. I'm saving her life. Relax. So he has to be the calm one.
I think that was spot on.
That's pretty. Well, I mean, even he even says that to Watson. He's like, will caring about them help them? No? Well, then why would I waste time?
When you're faced with a problem like that, being overly emotional is only going to get in the way and cloud judgment. And, I mean, it's like they tell you, if you're drowning or if you're in quicksand, don't struggle, don't panic.
Well, and Sherlock only focuses on what he feels is important to his analysis, because like if you hear about him, he doesn't know about the solar system because he says that's not relevant. I don't need to remember the solar system for doing what I want to do. And so he's going to focus and just remember the important facts that he sees as relevant. And everything else is just stuff that is taking up space in his head.
Yes, ma'am.
As an additional note for Watson, this is a man who survived the Battle of Maiwand, which is the bloodiest battle in the entire Afghanistan struggle. Like, no one walked out of this alive. And yet the fact that Watson came out of it alive and, like, still sane is just another, it's just more proof that he's this classically educated, strong personality, and you have to be that to be able to deal with someone like Sherlock Holmes.
And a little insane.
This lady had her hand up first, and then this lady over here. Go ahead, man.
Well, I just had one thing to add to her comment about that moment when Holmes asks, not good. I always loved that moment because it was like the first, for me, I guess, in the show, the first time Sherlock cares, like, is questioning, cares what people think about what he's saying. So, but my real question is this. Logically, what was the difference between what Watson does versus what the medical examiner does, because he's just a surgeon, not just a surgeon, but he's a surgeon. Why would he be more helpful than, the medical examiner?
Do you mean to Sherlock or like to the actual police force?
Well, I mean, Sherlock says he's making a point, bringing Watson in. So I'm like, what's the point? I mean, I understand the emotional connection. I just didn't quite get how he was bringing more science to it than a medical examiner.
He was, the point that he was making was more that he could do whatever he wanted because they need him, Sherlock. Okay. So he can bring in this doctor that has nothing to do with it. Literally just waltzes into a crime scene with a person with absolutely no one knows who he is, and he just keeps saying, he's with me, he's with me. And he lets him examine this dead body in a crime scene because they have to do it because otherwise Sherlock won't work with him.
Yes, ma'am.
I was just going to say, in the novels, in the book, Watson is an intelligent, he's portrayed as an intelligent character. I think it's the portrayal of Nigel Bruce, in the early Nigel Bruce and Basil Rathbone. Somehow, when they did those films, the character that they had him portray was a bumbling person who just didn't quite get it. I don't know whether they were trying to make a bigger difference between him and make the Sherlock Holmes character look more intelligent, but in the process, they just succeeded in making Watson look dumber.
I've always preferred the Jeremy Brett and Edward Hardwick.
Yeah.
All right, I saw this young lady over here in the pink, who's not looking at me. And then you had a question, sir?
Yes.
Oh, okay. We'll go with this young lady right here and then this gentleman.
I'm sorry, I talk a lot. Anyway,
Another part of the point was, the major point, I think, was, you know, was obviously the, yeah, no, they need me, and I can do whatever I, you know, damn well please. So, but another point was, you know, I'm getting you out of the house, John.
Yeah.
There was also an element of, look, I have a friend now.
Yeah.
I have a friend. I didn't meet him on the internet. It's awesome.
The way I look at it is, you know, somebody, again, like it's treated in the book, somebody to bounce ideas off of, and for Holmes to kind of bear his own conclusions. I mean, we're talking about kind of, you know, the not good moment. And I think really for Holmes, the moment when he first feels like Watson is someone on whom he can rely, is when Holmes deconstructs Watson's family life based off of his cell phone, and Watson is actually impressed with him. Yeah. He's like, well, really, what do you usually hear?
Yes, sir.
I mean, like, a lot of people talk about the idea of, you know, Watson feeling betrayed in a sort of bumbling, like, but it depends on the tonality of the series too, because that he normally serves that effect for comic relief, and the tonality of the seriousness of how in depth they are getting into how Sherlock is solving stuff matters a lot, and sometimes that's foiled in or dealt in different ways. Sometimes the police officers are more in that comedic light, and sometimes Sherlock himself is. It depends on which one you're looking at. The easiest one is your sidekick is really not, so that's why you get a lot of that.
I know we had a comment from a lady in the back, and we have this lady here, but I have a question to ask you, the audience. Do you think that the relationship between Holmes and Watson has directly influenced other relationships, say, like, between the doctor and his companion, historically?
Yes.
I know in the early 70s, when we had John Pertwee as the doctor, we also had a series of, we first had Lishaw, who was very smart and a scientist, and then we had Joe Grant, who was kind of bumbling and was, doctor, what do we do now? Or, how did you come to that conclusion? And there we have kind of both of the iterations of Watson. We have both the smart, capable Watson and then the slightly bumbling, by Joe Holmes, that was brilliant.
And you know, I like that bit after she's left, before Joe comes in, where apparently Liz complains and said that the doctor just wanted just somebody to polish his test tubes and tell him he was brilliant, which is wind up what we get it with Nigel Bruce. And
there was a young lady in the back. I don't know if she actually remembers Harry in her head. No? Okay, then we'll go with this lady here. Oh, okay, you did?
Oh, I guess, this is way on what John can bring that the meds doctors can't is also an element of, it doesn't matter that you guys won't play with me, I can bring in people who will, and there's not as many. So it's similar to your comment, but also just that it is someone who will actually get down on the ground next to the corpse with him, their faces right up, and who isn't Anderson.
Yes, ma'am.
I was trying to open that kind of conversation. I meant, don't medical examiners have different education?
No, it's the same basic is study in terms of getting your doctoral experience, and then at that point that they choose you into medical examiner, then there's an additional path in terms of that specialty.
This young lady over here, then this young lady, and then this one over here.
I was just going to say on the point that Watson and Sherlock, well, you have the Watson, when he first meets Sherlock, he doesn't say after Sherlock goes through his whole spiel, you're an idiot or you're a freak, or I think. The thing he says is, how did you do that? And what does Sherlock like more? He likes people who question things, who look at for like the answers and stuff. And then later on, when Sherlock actually explains everything, once again, Watson doesn't say, you know, you're a freak, how did you do this? He just goes, amazing. At which Sherlock once again thinks, because he's like, well, he appreciates someone who will come forth and say this and actually gets what he's doing and not just say, well, you're a freak, just don't, you know, bother anymore. Just go do your thing and leave us alone.
Honestly, even like, as a professional, like the medical examiner works for the police and everything, would have like a certain set of parameters or guidelines that he can't step out of or has to obey. whereas Watson with Sherlock, he can do, like, say, with, like, move the body or do things that the medical examiner can't.
Because he doesn't have to work on the police department.
Yeah, that, like, do you understand what I'm saying? Like, there's special parameters that the medical examiner and the cops, everybody have to stay within, where Watson and Sherlock don't. So that gives Watson a little bit more of a leeway than it would the medical examiner.
That's a very good comment. And you're right, the medical examiner and people on the police force, they do have that rule, that guideline. And Holmes and Watson wouldn't, because they're brought in as civilian consultants. So they wouldn't necessarily be bound by the police procedures.
And
really?
That's not necessarily.
Well, I mean, in
okay.
real life,
Holmes refuses
yes.
to be bound by those things. As a matter of fact, that's the point that Mycroft is kind of always making. But he does even comment on in the canon stories, but particularly in the new incarnation, Mycroft is basically like telling you, Sherlock should be working for my government. Sherlock is so smart and so brilliant, but Sherlock's like, I'm not going to work for a structured system.
That was my point, that Sherlock wants to.
Like, I'm not
going to
deal with that.
That's the point, that they don't have to, whereas these do.
We have this young lady here, and then this young lady, and then this one over
here,
and then we have someone in the back who's losing the blood in her arm. She's very patient, I'm sure. This young lady right here, yes, ma'am. All right. Yes, ma'am.
That's a good segue, thank you. I wanted to discuss my problem and how he's changed from canon to Sherlock, because he has a lot. You don't get the same sense of antagonism or world domination in canon. There's none of that. You get the feeling that he's perfectly happy being the quiet, Victorian human computer.
Yeah, and canon, he's kind of the smart fat guy that sits in his chair and lets the world spin around him. Seriously.
You know, I kind of think that one reason that change was made is because we kind of assume as a modern society that anyone who works for the government is going to be manipulative and know what's going on before anyone else does. So we kind of assume that Mycroft is like that anyway.
But don't you feel that being played by Mark Gatiss, there's a certain element of wanting to play that as a character too?
Yeah, I was wholly surprised with Mark Gatiss, because I did not see Mycroft. Because of course in the original stories, Mycroft is absolutely corpulent, and only goes three places: his home, his office, and the Diogenes spot.
Yeah, he in fact, when I was in England, there was a Q&A with Mark Gatiss over there, and he talked a little bit about it. How after he basically decided that they were going to just put him in that role, that's where that whole thing in the episodes come from about how's your diet going. It's like, instead of making him the fat one, he's like the yo-yo dieting Mycroft. Literally written kind of to encapsulate Mark Gatiss's act.
Yes, ma'am.
There's a wonderful comment. I'm not sure if it's in the actual Masterpiece series of episodes or if it was the on-air pilot. But Sherlock says genius needs an audience.
Yeah.
And that just basically encapsulates what Watson is.
We have this young lady up here, and then the lady in the back has been very patient, and then this lady here, this gentleman, and then we have someone in the back there. Go ahead.
Okay, two things. One, speaking about the whole following the rules thing, notice in the first episode, Watson is wearing a suit. He's wearing a blue suit. He comes into the crime scene, all dressed up in the, suits so he doesn't contaminate the evidence. But Sherlock, whatever. But from then on, do you see Watson in a blue suit? Nope. So there's that. And then also, Mr. Cumberbatch has said that he plays him not quite as a sociopath, but as someone with high-functioning autism.
Yes.
Yes.
Because and it's very much, he doesn't really relate to the world around him very well. And so that brought up the whole, is his sociopathy just a self-diagnosed thing? Or, what is it? Because he, to keep people from questioning him too much? Or, along those lines, because he really just doesn't get it. And he's never wanted to make the effort before meeting Tom. It's just not, why make an effort? I mean, think of Christmas dinner.
All right, finally, the young lady who had her hand up for so long, and then this young lady, and then this gentleman, and then we'll go from there. This young lady, and then we have someone over here. Go ahead.
Okay, I was talking about the relationship between Holmes and Watson. I was, especially in this modern incarnation, seeing the Watson's relationship with Holmes. He's using it as kind of a crutch because he's very shell-shocked. He's gotten involved with a man who's sociopathic, who solves problems without emotion, through logic and strength. And that's a way for Watson to dodge around his own inability to resolve his trauma. So in a way, he's doing something, you know, he's being active, he's helping, and he doesn't have to actually think and emotionally go through what happened to him in the war.
Actually, historically, the original Watson kind of did the same thing. Because
yeah.
He fought in the Afghan wars then, came home and was invalided and invalided out because he had received a wound. And
traveling
move. Yeah, of course, we travel all the way from Afghan to England. So definitely Watson is working through his own issues as he works with Sherlock Holmes. Experts, what do you think? It's midnight.
Have you already got the part where Mycroft basically confronts Watson and says, all right, well, we read the job for United Express, but it's not an issue of you needing to get over it to achieve some kind of normalcy. No, you want that fast-paced action. You want that stress.
And there's just a very literal metaphor of that placed in with the whole John having that psychosomatic limp. And as soon as Sherlock starts on, and it's kind of, I mean, it very literally is a depiction of that idea that he's using Sherlock as a crutch for his emotional and mental anguish.
Yeah, and you could certainly see that, of course, when, Sherlock emails the restaurant to bring back Watson's cane. He said you forgot this.
Ladies and gentlemen, I know you have more comments and questions, but we have about 15 more minutes, and I thought we might want to go over a little bit about Series 2.
So I know they've announced the three titles for the series, and they've filmed them out of order, too, which is interesting, and I think some of it had to do with actor casting and availability. But the episodes are going to be, one is A Scandal in Belgravia, which is going to be written by Stephen Moffat. The second one, which I think is going to be exceedingly fun, is called The Hound of the Baskervilles. Yeah. And that one was written by Mark Gatiss, who also just wrote the Doctor Who episode that we had the preview last night. And we know one of the other people that's been cast in that is Russell Tovey, who's from the Being Human. Henry Baskerville. And there is a short clip of him that has shown up on the BBC promos. It's about 2 seconds of him reacting to Holmes. It looks really good. And then the third one is based on the book, The Final Problem, and the title of the third episode is called The Reichenbach Fall. And that was written by Steve Thompson. Does anybody not know who Russell Tovey is? He plays the werewolf in the British version of Being Human.
Has anyone seen the History Boys?
Yes. History Boys. He's Grudge. He's Grudge in History Boys. He plays the Spanish guy.
Voyage of the Damned, Doctor Who.
Don't watch it.
You don't watch Doctor Who? Here's the stickers. Oh my god.
Here's a really obscure reference. He's in Him and Her, which is a British comedy.
Oh, yeah.
Which was also about young, unemployed, and hired. We also know that Irene Adler is going to be in the series, and she's going to be played by Laura Pulver. And she is known for Robin Hood and True Blood. She plays Claudine. It's very interesting we've got Irene Adler in this version of Sherlock, because she's also, that character is going to be in the movie. That's as well. And so the movie is coming out Christmas. The guy Ritchie directed one. And Somebody was asking about when the episodes are going to air. They're still, I think they've wrapped up filming. They're actually affected by the riots.
They're done.
The filming is wrapped.
They shut down for today's screen writing, but then they wrapped up on the
weekend. Yeah. And so now they're in editing and trying to pull it together. And I believe they've not officially announced a British date for airing, but it sounds like it's going to be next year for Britain, probably January. And it's going to air on PBS in the United States. And I think, I've heard as late as May.
In the States.
States. Way back.
Yeah, the question is?
I'm just going to say one thing. I don't know how many people are going to agree with this, but I'm a little bit scared about our writer for our finale.
Yes!
He wrote, in my opinion, the absolute the center episode of The Blindmaker, which is by far the the current series, and they're giving him the biggest finale to script. I'm a little scared. Like, I don't think it's going to be ruined or anything, but I'm still scared.
I saw the gentleman back here with his hands up first.
No, I actually think that him writing the finale is a good sign because I think it means they're planning series 3. Because if that was the actual finale, Moffat and Gatiss would be fighting over who was yet to write it. So, if it's good, it means 3 more episodes.
So, I mean, there is the question, how are they going to get out of where we wrapped up the series 1? So we've got to get out of that
in little pieces.
And
maybe the pool was something, you know, Reckenbach or whatever, you know, like aquatics facility. Until we heard about the, you know, the secretaries. And the title's there, but it was, I think that looking into the third series is, as the person back there said, yeah, no, I think that the most important episode to write, I don't think you should be worried about him writing the finale, because no matter what goes wrong,
It'll be fixed.
In that next episode where, you know, I really, really hope to goodness John Swanson. So,
It was just basically like, there's a point to staying to the original and being important, but sometimes characters back then weren't quick right the part as well. That's not a comic relief, and the character's not adding to the story, then there's no real reason to have it. So if you're going to have boring characters, they don't serve a purpose in that medium. Sometimes they do. If you've ever, like, seen a movie version of a Shakespeare play, it's never as good as a good production of a Shakespeare play, in my opinion, and many other people's have been seeing that. So if you're going to rehash just a little bit different and keep the same characters that weren't necessarily amazing the first time, I don't see that point when you have the possibility of taking amazing characters and adding to the cast and potentially making a new medium that's just as good.
Yeah, I'm going to make this really quick because we've been kind of shying away from talking about the Robert Downey Jr. Jude Law. But that was the chief thing that bothered me in that movie was Irene Adler. And not even her, it's just not even what happened there, but the idea that basically what they did was create an original character and stick a name from canon on it.
Yes.
It's not Irene Adler. Yeah. It has nothing to do with her. You could have named her anything. And you would have had it, you know. But instead, you've got someone who's completely out of the, away from that, and that's what makes it so bad. It's not necessarily the character itself, it's that they stuck this important figure name, which, again, is another character that's only in one of the stories, and did that.
Yeah, I think our expectations there will be a third series, because we've been doing this in a partnership. I mean, BBC has been looking for partners for doing money, for funding this, because it was one of the reasons Doctor Who got pushed back when it did, and they did specials that 1 year, because they were trying to find funding sources. So you're seeing a lot of stuff like how Torchwood got partnered with Stars. I think PBS has signed on to help with them.
All right. Well, we have a couple of prizes to give away, and like our previous panel, they have absolutely nothing to do with Sherlock Holmes.
Fuck yeah!
We have Elizabeth I. The autobiography of Henry VIII, author of the autobiography of Henry VIII. Not Henry VIII. Just give it to you. Well, if you can answer the question we're going to come up with, you can have it. And the other one is, I'd say, a modern descendant of Sherlock Holmes, Doctor Who. The Faceless Ones. So, our panelists, do we have a Sherlock trivia question?
I think I've got a good one.
You have a good one? Okay.
Yeah. Who is the costume designer? Designed the outfit that Cumberbatch wore. What was the...
Show of hands. Show of hands.
So, costume designer.
Shouting out the
What was the type of coat, and how much did the coat cost?
I can do the name, but I can't do the name.
Okay, maybe a question that's not quite so hard. Does anyone know the answer?
Can we go with the coat and the cost? Because I have a feeling someone can probably
come up with the
coat and the cost.
Come on.
Okay.
Sorry, the cost of the coat.
Do you know the answer to that?
Yes. The cost of the coat?
Yeah.
£1,000.
Yes.
£1,000.
Come here and
get
this
book. The belly staff coat in the series.
The book is also £1,000.
Thank you.
Costume designer is Ray Holman.
Well,
all right.
Can we call him?
Can we have, as challenging a question that was, can we have a slightly less challenging?
Okay, we dissed the blind bank earlier, but what original home story is that based upon?
Yes, so this young lady over here up first.
The Dancing Men?
Yes.
Yeah. Come up here and get your book.
It's my favorite home story.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to go ahead and thank our panelists here, Taylor Blumberg, John Brayden, John Brothers. I'd really like to thank y'all. Y'all are really making this panel just jump. Thank you very much for coming to the Sherlock panel. If you like what you heard, or if you like something, or if there's something else you like, please leave a comment in our suggestion box.
And if it does work out, if my audio is good enough, it will be coming up for the Baker Street Babes podcast. We're on iTunes and at
BakerStreetBabes.blogspot.com. And don't forget the LJ
Timber meetup
outside.
LJ Timber meter outside.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming to Brookside.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2 to 1?